in our fourth day without power. Got a kind of a kludged together system here from kind of a partial generator operating in the building, and that's how we're able to do what we're doing right now. Dr. Stuart Hameroff is my guest, and he's an anesthesiologist and obviously a brilliant one. We're discussing consciousness, and we were talking about the brain being warm, and the doctor is saying traditional scientists would say, well, the brain cannot operate in a quantum fashion because it's simply too warm to do so. But he believes that the human brain has some special function that even when warm is able to operate in a quantum state. All absolutely fascinating stuff. And you've got to wonder, if we're operating in a quantum state, if our brain is operating in a quantum state, then perhaps it accounts for, well, I don't know, those strange things that we see that seem to, I don't know, eclipse time and space and even the world between the living and dead at times. I wonder what the doctor would say about that. We'll be right back. Doctor, let us assume for a moment that you are correct, and even though our brains are too warm, according to the critics, to be functioning in a quantum manner, let's assume they are, and doing very well at it indeed. And now I'm going to take you out on a limb here. Isn't it possible, then, that a lot of what scientists deny or simply don't understand about communications that people claim to get from the other side or from other... what's the right word here? What am I struggling for? From other entities, that some of these could be absolutely real from a quantum perspective.
Well, you are putting me on the spot, Art. And before I answer that, let me just say I'm sorry to hear about the typhoon in Manila, and I hope that you and everyone there weather it as well as possible, and good luck with the next one that's coming.
Yeah, thank you.
But I'm not trying to evade the question. Yes, I think that quantum effects can account for many non-local effects lumped together, paranormal, whatever you want to say. And I'd rather not address any in particular specifically, but just generally, yes. And we're getting some pretty good, you know, Rupert Sheldrake's new data on the sense of being stared at with TV monitors and all kinds of things are very interesting. And I think quantum mechanisms are the only possible explanation. I think that consciousness is kind of a process on the edge between the quantum world and the classical world. It's the quantum world becoming the classical world. And so the quantum stuff is normally on the unconscious side, but of course we have direct access to it, so it's normally unconscious, but can be conscious. And yes, I think there can be non-local interactions due to quantum effects.
All right. Well, you jumped off that one very well indeed. Are you aware of the work you have to be going on at Princeton?
Yeah, the Pear Labs, Roger Nelson, and
that's right.
Yeah, those guys, and yeah, they've done great work for years, and the random number generator stuff, and with Dean Radin and Dick Berman, is very interesting, and I think compelling, and I think Dean has now come out with a quantum entanglement explanation for his result in his latest book. He was at the last Tucson conference also. And so I think, yeah, that's you know, those types of effects have to be quantum mechanical.
And what do you think about the concept of individual consciousness versus some sort of collective consciousness, which, of course, is what Princeton, they're not really certain that it's collective, but it seems to be leaning that way.
Well, I think a lot of people are grappling with the concept that there's some kind of information Platonic information, using Roger Penrose's term and going back to Plato's idea of an absolute realm of pure truth and ideas and beauty and aesthetics and so forth, but that it's real. It's not, and that it's real in a sense that can be described through modern physics at the very fundamental level of the universe, what the universe is made of at the nitty-gritty level that, you know, string theory tries to approach it, quantum loop, quantum gravity, quantum geometry, things of that nature, describe a pattern, a structure of everything, of the most basic level, which gives rise to everything, because mass is, whether it's strings vibrating or curvature of space-time geometry or some types, some description at that level, it's some kind of non-local medium at the basic level, which is called the Planck scale, the ultimately small level of reality, where things have information and things are non-local, almost maybe holographic, interconnected all over the place.
Well, obviously, it eclipses time in some manner, because, as you know, if you looked at some of the results they had at Princeton, prior to 9/11, I forget whether it was a half an hour, hour and a half, whatever it was, there was a significant, small but significant amount of time where the reaction to the 9/11 events began 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour prior to the actual event. Now, it's not just 9/11, it's many events where this occurred. So that would seem to put it outside the realm of time in some manner, quantum, I suppose.
Yeah. There are a couple of ways to look at it, but if from the classical world, which we basically think we live in, looking at it, it would seem effects were going backwards in time, so that some type of correlation occurred from the future, from the near future, and probably the duration, how far back in time or how far into the future you can get information might. I don't know, it might depend on the intensity of the event. 9/11 being an ultimately intense event caused backward time, like a day, I thought Dean Radin said in some cases. But normally, I think we get information from like a fraction of a second, several hundred milliseconds in the future. But it could be longer. The thing about it is that time, you know, has no actual place in physics. I'm not a physicist, but as I understand it, we could do without the concept of time. At least the flow of time. I mean, does time really flow? In fact, an earlier viewer before I came on was talking about time speeding up, and I was thinking that we don't really know that time flows in and of itself. I mean, is it a dimension that we move in? If so, we should be able to go in both directions, forwards and backwards, or is it a process that it itself evolves, or does time exist at all? And some people, Julian Barber, for example, says that the universe is a collage of instantaneous frames, instantaneous moments, and how they're connected is somewhat arbitrary. We think they move forward in a logical way through our memory, but that's a little extreme. What I think is that there are sequences moving forward in time that are consciousness, because when the quantum world collapses to reality, that's a frame of consciousness if it happens a certain way, and then you have another one and another one and another one, and these are like the specious moments that William James talked about, forming a stream of consciousness, a stream of frames moving forward that are each kind of a collapse from the quantum world to the classical, creating reality within our heads.
All right. Well, I forget who it was, but somebody described to me time this way. They said, well, prior to the Big Bang, for example, there was nothing, and therefore there could not be time. After the Big Bang, we then, as soon as we had two objects moving relative to each other, we could make an observation. We could say, well, all right, the moon or that planet over there or whatever is moving either toward us or away from us or in conjunction with us at the following speed. And so we now have a way to measure something. We now have time.
Well, that sounds good. I don't know if that solves the basic problem of whether it's a process or a dimension or whether it exists at all, because it still remains. St. Augustine said, I know what time is until someone asks me to explain it, and then I don't know what it is. And you can say the same thing about consciousness. But some people think that the flow of time is associated, that consciousness creates a flow of time. For example, if we have a certain number of, if consciousness is a sequence of frames, kind of like a movie is a sequence of frames, the audience perceives it as a continuum. And we have a sequence of frames occurring in our head. The frames are in our head, and we experience each one, but it seems continuous because there's nothing in between. We're unconscious in between, like maybe in the quantum world. And so roughly 40 times a second we have these frames, but that rate can change. For example, people in car accidents say, the car was spinning in the world. Everything slowed down. Everything was in slow motion.
That's right.
And Michael Jordan, they asked him, how could he be such a great player? And he said, when I'm playing well, it's like the other team, the defense is in slow motion, and I can make more moves than they can. So maybe Michael Jordan is having, instead of 40 frames per second, he's having 60 frames per second. So it's going to appear to him that the other team is in relative slow motion because his conscious time is faster than theirs, and he'll be able to pull more moves than they can.
That's a good explanation. Can there be a scientific a way to account for spirituality or a religious belief?
I think, it's the same thing that you asked before about the different types of communication, because I think if there is at the fundamental level of the universe a vast storehouse, I don't know what to call it, of platonic information of wisdom and truth and aesthetic values that connect everything to everything else and can guide our actions and our conscious processes, then that approach is something that could be related to spirituality, at least pull another layer of the onion off of what's underlying it, because I think there must be some scientific explanation.
All right, let's jump to near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. I had one of those, and it was quite remarkable, but near-death as well. All in the same ballpark or not? Is there some sort of separation here, or just all the sort of same quantum function?
Several years ago, the BBC did a show about near-death and out-of-body experiences called The Day I Died. Did you happen to see that?
I did not.
And they interviewed me because the guys who did the study in Europe, and they asked them how they could explain out-of-body experiences. They said, we don't know. Ask Penrose or Hameroff. Roger Penrose is the eminent physicist in England with whom I collaborate. And they asked me, and what I said and what I say in the show is that normally inner consciousness is occurring in this fundamental level of space-time geometry within the proteins and structures in the brain that account for consciousness, which couples our consciousness to this fundamental level. And the biochemistry of the brain provide the pump, the coherence, to create this quantum state coupling between the brain and this fundamental level. And then when the brain stops working, when the heart stops and there's no perfusion, the coherence is lost, but the quantum information is occurring at this fundamental level. So it isn't destroyed. It just kind of dissipates to the universe at large, maybe, but stays entangled so that the person's entity or soul or whatever you want to, consciousness remains coherent. And when the brain is revived, it can be kind of rejoin the body. And if it isn't revived, then it just maybe it mingles at that level at large.
Well, that's a whole other question. But with regard to, for example, out-of-body experiences are difficult, but with near-death experiences, there is a certain amount of perhaps even real evidence that people are able to relate things that were going on that is just impossible for them to have known. Now, have you read enough evidence for you to believe that these NDEs, particularly the ones where they see the resuscitation efforts, they're able to relate what was said, they're able to relate what was going on in the room, that sort of thing?
Well, I've seen a lot of it, and I've read some reports. I'm fairly convinced. I'm not 100% convinced, because in all cases, the case that Spetzler described, with the woman in Atlanta was very compelling. But and I've also debated this issue with some very harsh skeptical people in the consciousness studies who claim almost all of this stuff is rubbish. Susan Blackmore, the professional skeptic from England, for example, and she'll point to the, so I'm used to debating this, but I'm pretty it seems pretty compelling overall.
You were in the film What Bleep?
Yeah.
What exactly did you do in it?
They interviewed me for 6 hours in the desert with beautiful cactus, and then from that took excerpts. I'm in the film maybe a total of 5 minutes here and there, and at the end in the credits, I shoot a basketball, hit a jumper from the top of the key because we were filming up by a playground, and that's in my that's my claim to fame.
I see. I imagine you've had a lot of feedback just as a result of that appearance, right?
Yes. It was fun being in a movie. I really had no idea what it was going to... I mean, they just asked me if I wanted to be in a film about quantum physics and consciousness, and I said, well, sure. And anyway, it all came together, and it wasn't quite what I expected, but
it never is.
No,
yeah, it never is.
But it planted the seed of quantum physics and consciousness, which is a great thing. So, it was fun being in it. It was fun being in the follow up rabbit hole version, and it kind of got me the movie bug because I became involved in making a film about consciousness specifically, which is something I'm heavily involved in at the moment.
Doctor, I did something a number of years ago, which I'm sure you've probably heard about. I sort of got onto this whole field of mass consciousness, and I in the early days just sort of started fooling around. I realized that I have access to millions of people at any given moment, as we do right now, and I asked millions of people to concentrate on changing the weather. Now, I did this in locations where there had not been rain in a very, very long time, in Texas and Western Canada and other areas that were just absolutely starved for rain. There was no rain in the forecast, no possibility of rain in the forecast. Hadn't been rain in a long time. I got millions of people together, had them concentrate for long periods of time, from a radio point of view, you know, 4, 5, 6 minutes, on nothing but creating, you know, thinking in their minds, picturing moisture gathering, clouds forming, and rain falling. And by God, within an hour or two, in areas where it simply could not have happened, time after time after time, Doctor, we created rain. Or I guess I ought to say rain occurred where it should not have. In one instance, there was so damn much rain that it flooded. Now, these experiments I did about, I don't know, not 10 or 11 of them, I guess, total. And finally, they all worked, and they worked so well that it scared the hell out of me. And I realized I didn't have the first clue of what I was toying with. People began to urge me to try to turn hurricanes away from the coast and do all kinds of different things. And I quickly realized that I didn't know what I was doing and stopped the experiments and tried to urge anybody else with the inclination to do so to also not do it until we could possibly begin to understand what we were playing with. Does that seem like a wise course of action to you?
To stop doing it?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. I think the world right now could use all the help it can get. There's a lot of things that, you know, assuming it
there works. There is certainly that point of view. Let me tell you what I worried about. People wanted me to move toward, you know, diverting the course, for example, of a hurricane. And I thought, well, yeah, maybe we could give that a shot. But what if... since we don't really know what we're doing, what if we do divert a hurricane, for example, away from the coast, give it 2 more days in the ocean, and then the effect of what we're doing wears off, and during those 2 days it goes from a heavy tropical storm to a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, then hits land. In other words, I didn't really know totally what I was doing, and I saw many possibilities for error with catastrophic results. That's why I stopped, Doctor.
First, do no harm. That's the first rule of medicine.
Yes, that's right. Do no harm. And I was afraid that without understanding the force, which I was willy-nilly directing, I might indeed do harm. So that's why I stopped. But you're right about the condition of the world right now. It's less than ideal, isn't it?
All right, Doctor,
I'm sorry. We're right up against it. We'll be right back. Stay right where you are. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm not saying that there would not be an instance in which I would throw caution to the wind and go ahead and use what I believe to be a very powerful force, ultimately, perhaps greater than atomic energy. I have no idea. That's for some future generation probably to discover. But, you know, if there were if there was a big 5-mile rock headed toward Earth, or the condition of the environment had deteriorated to the point where people's lives were threatened, albeit we're getting somewhat close to that right now, then I might throw all caution to the wind and go ahead and do it. But short of something very immediate like that, I don't think so. We'll get back to Dr. Hameroff in a moment. Once again, Dr. Stuart Hameroff, he's an anesthesiologist talking to us about consciousness, an incredible interview, actually. Doctor, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Art.
Anyway, that's sort of my take on it. I watched this really, really happen. And when you, 9 or 10 or 11 times, have seen this actually occur, it's kind of frightening. I mean, it's fascinating on the one hand, but it's a little frightening on the other hand, because you really can't know the ultimate outcome of some of what you might do. But it indicated to me that many minds, and this is where the question is going, many minds concentrating on one outcome can be more powerful than a single mind concentrating its intent on an outcome. What do you think?
If they were entangled together, then they'd be more more powerful. I have to say that it seems more likely to be able to have an influence on another quantum process, for example, consciousness. I'm impressed by, you know, what you say about the weather patterns. I just kind of look at all kinds of things as possibilities without, you know, dwelling on any one in particular, because I think overall it's pretty overwhelming for some type of non-local interaction. But if you could do, well, as you said, you don't know what's going to happen, whether it's going to go to the Gulf and pick up more warm water and become even worse. Unintended consequences, as we're seeing in the world political,
you know.
So, yeah, you have to be careful of that. But, you know, I think affecting something like consciousness, just people meditating on for peace or whatever is definitely a good thing. It certainly can't harm. I don't think you have unintended consequences there. I would hope not, anyway.
I would hope not, too. And, you know, praying for peace, that's kind of where I drew the line. I mean, prayer is fine. Normally, if people are praying for something, it's not a negative outcome of some sort. It's hopefully for, you know, health or whatever, some kind of good outcome. And I suppose that's generally okay. But getting millions and millions of people together and having them actually concentrate on a particular outcome, I don't know. I need to understand, we all need to understand more about what we're doing in this area, I think, before playing too much with it. And you know, the people I've interviewed on this subject who were involved in the Princeton Project tend to agree with that. In fact, they were very concerned, Doctor, that even my being aware early on of what was going on at Princeton would affect their monitoring various outcomes. Just the fact that a lot of people knew about it and were thinking about it might affect the outcome. So they sort of concurred with me.
Okay. Well, I think that's the safest bet.
Very interesting stuff. Now, what do you think about an afterlife? If I heard you correctly earlier, you sort of seemed to suggest that everything might be scattered from here to Timbuktu, still together in some quantum manner. But when you physically die, Do you think there's any chance at all that what we understand to be consciousness continues in any recognizable form at all?
Consciousness, including unconsciousness, as quantum information, as I said before, could be viewed as existing at this fundamental level of the universe in whatever it's made of. People call it spin. Let's just say spin, as patterns of spin, which are non-local and holographic. So it's scattered from here to Timbuktu, but in a holographic-type periodic array. It's just information embedded in a different way than we normally, you know, more like a hologram than what we use in computers. So, yeah, it's possible, I think. You know.
So in other words, you're saying, yeah, it may be scattered from here to Timbuktu, but with the quantum world, it's possible that there's still enough or plenty of connection, no matter where everything is scattered to, so that there could be some sort of consciousness.
Yes, or unconscious. Unconscious meaning more in the subconscious realm, more in the dream world. It'd be like more of a dream world than our classical world. That's what the existence would be like, but it would be real. I think it's possible anyway. And even, you know, under that paradigm, even reincarnation is possible.
That's really interesting. It would be real. So that takes us to a definition of what is real. So a dream, even though it's a dream, is real.
We certainly have an awareness during our dreams, and you know we can argue about Freud or whatever drives our dreams or Jung or whatever. But the point is that even as bizarre as they are, in fact, the bizarreness seems to suggest that dreams use quantum logic. There was a South American psychologist, Mate Blanco, who studied the dreams for 30 years and came up with this logic structure, which is different from our everyday logic. And he gave various examples that things can be all in multiple places or states at the same time. Time more or less disappears. So the point is that some people think that dreams, the bizarreness of dreams, are the bizarreness of the quantum world, and that dreams are quantum information. And if they collapsed and became classical, that would be consciousness. But they stay in the unconscious. So that kind of unconscious consciousness, dreaming type consciousness, I think could exist in some sense even after life. In principle, it's possible.
Yeah, and you even feel reincarnation is a possibility. I've always kind of complained about reincarnation in the sense that I guess the classical view of reincarnation is that you keep coming back until you get it right, sort of a move toward perfection, kind of a classroom type deal, and you keep coming back until you get it right. But I've always complained that, well, how do you get it right if you can't remember the past wrongs, but perhaps subconsciously or through the process of a quantum connection, you at some level do remember these things you had wrong?
Yeah, that's possible, plus the whole sense of time breaks down. But I don't know that, I mean, you could have reincarnation without necessarily trying to achieve perfection or nirvana. I mean, maybe just that's just the way things are. We just keep coming back.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't
maybe
know.
So.
It's just, in principle, it's possible. That's really the point I want to make, I think.
Okay. You have a Center for Consciousness Studies there at the University of Arizona, is that correct?
Yes, we started that in 97 or so with a grant from the Fetzer Institute to start a Center for Consciousness Studies. We had started in 1994 with really the first international and interdisciplinary conference called Toward a Science of Consciousness, where we attempted to bring philosophers, neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, computer scientists, physicists, biologists, meditators, gurus, artists, whoever really had a take on the multifaceted problem of consciousness, which is, you know, kind of like the blind man and the elephant, feeling it by hand, depends on your perspective. So the only way to solve the problem, I think, is to bring all these people together, which is what we tried to do. And it's been fairly successful, and we've held these conferences every 2 years since 94. The last one was this past April. They're always April in the even years in Tucson. And it's helped to form a worldwide community in consciousness studies. Many other consciousness studies was under a rock for most of the 20th century because of the behaviorists, you know, who thought it wasn't worthwhile studying something which couldn't be directly measured or observed. So they got into behavior, learning, memory, a lot of rats in mazes type experiments, and consciousness became almost a dirty word. It wasn't really till the 80s. Late 80s, Roger Penrose and Francis Crick and some others, eminent people, brought it kind of back into respectability. And in the early 90s, we started this conference and later formed the Center for Consciousness Studies.
Well, speaking of respectability, how has the rest of the scientific community, I mean, there's still an awful lot of resistance to all of this, isn't there?
Yes, and I get flack. You know, Roger Penrose and I put out this theory of consciousness, the orchestrated objective reduction theory, it's called it. Basically, in a nutshell, we think there's a type of quantum computation going on inside these structures called microtubules in the dendrites. People can look at my website if they want the details. But we began to attract flack immediately from conventional philosophers and computational neuroscientists and computer people who want the brain to be equivalent to a classical computer and didn't like the idea of that there was a necessity for quantum computation, even though we point out that classical computing ideas cannot even begin to account for the many of the issues about consciousness. So it's been quite a contentious and interesting 12 years or so of this consciousness studies business.
Well, I can understand why they would be upset. For example, the computer people here in the world obviously think that they are approaching real artificial intelligence, and if what you believe is true, they're not, and they're not going to get there until they get a quantum computer, yes?
A particular type of quantum computer. It was actually Roger Penrose who began this kind of pushback against the AI juggernaut with his 1989 book called The Emperor's New Mind, like The Emperor's New Clothes. He's pointing out that AI being the emperor really had nothing going. It was just all a bunch of hype, and we just need a bigger, faster, give us another 100 billion and, or 100 million and we'll have it for you, that sort of thing. And he kind of called their bluff, and they weren't very happy about it.
I imagine they're still not.
They're still pissed.
You can say that. For sure you can say that. I would imagine they are, because they think they're making progress in that direction. And
They are. They're making a lot of progress. The problem is that calling it consciousness and brain equivalence.
Give me a test, doctor. How would you know? Give me a test that you would lay down for them to, in other words, what would you have to see to say, okay, you've achieved AI?
Well, it depends. If you mean consciousness, I mean, AI is many things. The only objection that I'm making is when they claim to be able to produce consciousness.
Well, and that's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking about. But a lot of times, you see a lot of bait and switch things.
I know.
You know, they talk about consciousness, and then they wind up talking about memory or attention or behavior. And these are all important things. These are what philosopher David Chalmers calls the easy problems. The hard problem is conscious awareness itself. But it's also, as you pointed out a moment ago, difficult, if not impossible, to prove that a system is conscious, because consciousness is unobservable. We just depend on first-person report. I know I'm conscious. I assume you are, but you could be what philosophers call a zombie, a complex behaving entity that looks and acts like us, but isn't really has no inner life, has no nothing going on inside. It's all just reflexive behaviors.
There have been accusations like that. Listen, doctor, what kind of test would you apply if somebody represented to you that they had achieved artificial intelligence and you could sit in front of that computer and either question it or in some way, question it? What kind of test would you apply to that machine to try and find out if they had actually achieved consciousness?
Boy, that's a very difficult question. And, that applies to the AI people. It also applies to, the people on my side of the fence who think that you need a certain type of quantum computer, if we did that, how would we know it's conscious? And I don't know of an answer to that right now, because consciousness is completely subjective. There might be ways to tell through their behaviors, if they're non-computable, if they bring in something outside of an algorithm, because that's Roger's contention that characterizes conscious thought. But I don't know. There's been a lot of movies about that, of things becoming conscious and whatnot, and taking it. And it's just I don't have a good answer yet. Sorry about that. I define it as a particular type of quantum collapse, but how I would prove that that has consciousness, I don't know. I only know that
quantum. Wait a minute. A quantum collapse.
Right. You know, in the early days of quantum mechanics, they would have a system that would be in multiple places or states at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. And but it would stay that, and they knew this. It would stay that way until somebody looked at it. And as soon as somebody observed it or measured it, it would collapse the wave function, they called it, from being in, say, a spin up and a spin down in superposition. As soon as you opened the box and looked at it, it would instantaneously become either spin up or spin down with a 50-50 probability. And so they believe that consciousness caused collapse of the wave function. But we think it's the other way around. We think that a particular type of self-collapse of the wave function occurring in the brain is a conscious moment. And whenever this occurs, there is a moment of conscious awareness. That's the theory I developed with Roger Penrose, because he came up with this idea of the self-collapse being something tied to this fundamental level of the universe at the Planck scale, where we think conscious experience and unconscious and conscious experience may emanate, may be embedded at that level. So we made this connection between the brain and that fundamental level.
Is that theory gaining ground?
I think so. I get a lot more flack all the time, so I think I take that as a good sign. I think it's much better to be criticized than ignored. And there are articles attacking us all the time. And I think that's because AI really hasn't really got a real theory of consciousness. Neurocomputation, I think, would be a more correct term for the general idea. I mean, their approach doesn't jive with the EEG data of what correlates with consciousness. It forces us to be illusions and helpless spectators because of the fact that consciousness occurs after we've acted. So without quantum mechanics, consciousness is in deep trouble. It's an illusion. It's an epiphenomenon occurring after the fact. And this is what, you know, leading proponents, Daniel Dennett, Pat Churchland, Christoph Koch, believe, because, you know, they won't consider the possibility of quantum mechanisms which could rescue consciousness from the sad state of affairs.
Okay. Here's one that you can avoid if you want, but I'd love an answer to it. Is there any current religion on Earth that you think is closer to the real thing than the others?
Well, wow. I guess Buddhism, because it's closest with quantum physics, and I've heard people use the term quantum Zen Buddhism. There've been a lot of books about it, and nobody's got it correct yet, I don't believe, but we're getting closer all the time. I mean, there are so many analogies and similarities between Buddhism and quantum physics. In fact, the yin-yang symbol reminds me of the classical and the quantum worlds, with some kind of surface or edge between the two. So, and then you have the universal mind, at least in some forms of Buddhism you do. And also, people talked about this at the Tucson conference. John Dunn from Emory, a religion professor, talked about Tibetan monks who report on deep meditation of nothingness. Okay, they're just meditating on pure compassion. They report a frequency, a regularity, a periodicity occurring at this fundamental level, and they quantified it. At first, it was something like 129th a snap of a finger, or something like that. But they actually figured it out, the math, and it matches closely to the gamma synchrony frequency found in EEG correlating with consciousness. So,
all right, I can't break it down that far, but listen, we've got a break coming up, so hold tight, Doctor. Dr. Stuart Ameroff is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. And listen, folks, when we come back, we're going to open the phone lines. I've had my shot with the doctor. Coming up, it's your turn.